this is a good one. My husband seems to be fine. I'm the one that has lapses or wonders if he really loves me. It's been 8 years. He feels that I should be over it and move on. How do I move on if I don't know where I fit? We are not close like we used to be, and according to my husband, it's because of me.
Well, this is Mona, if you want me to jump in on that one.
Have at it.
Have at it. If this was a woman that was sitting in front of me, just for ease, we'll assume it's a woman. Well, she did. She said her husband. Okay. So I would say to her that it really sounds like she has not healed from the infidelity, from the wound of the infidelity. And to continue to pretend that she's healed when she's not isn't working. So I would encourage that woman to go back to her husband and convey to him that she's not healed and she needs help to heal, and she's willing to do whatever it'll take to get there. Because what she really wants is a marriage where there is the intimacy and the relationship that is, as of this time now, still missing. And invite him to go with her to get that help, but even if he won't, to go on her own to get some help to figure out what it is that is preventing her from moving on after 8 years.
I completely agree, Mona. This is Leslie.
Okay, guys. Here's another one on triggers. I have so many triggers, and when I trigger, all the time. I don't want to tell my wife and take her back there as well, but I want to be transparent. Withholding my emotions got us into this mess in the first place, but me being sad all the time isn't an option either. How do I stop thinking about it? How do I get him out of my head and out of my bed? Boy.
So, Rick, we're talking, this is a male betrayed spouse?
Yeah, triggers, I have so many triggers all the time. I don't want to tell my wife and take her back as well, take her back there as well. So I guess this is the, sounds like this is
the person who had the affair is having
had
the triggers.
The affair and having triggers and
had the affair?
Yeah. Rick, there's two thoughts that come to my mind immediately when I hear that question. And the first one, you know, he's saying basically that he doesn't want to share these triggers of the affair with his spouse who he hurt because he doesn't want to bring her back there. So he feels that he's protecting his spouse. But sometimes I find it's often themselves that they're protecting. And what he doesn't realize is when, you know, like it was when Brian started coming to me and sharing things like that, well, this is a struggle for me, or this is what I was thinking of. That was actually what I think Mona referred to earlier as translucent honesty. And it actually had the reverse effect. What this unfaithful person thinks it's going to take them backwards, I think it would take them forwards, because it's like a bittersweet. Sometimes you're not, you know, it's not that you want to hear those things, but on the other hand, there's such a sense of relief. Whew, I'm finally getting the truth. I know my husband at last. He's sharing with me. He's no longer hiding. And from there, that openness and honesty can begin to rebuild the relationship. The other thing that I think this husband hasn't thought about is that I generally find that both people in the relationship are really smart, and that I would imagine that there's a good possibility that this wife may have ideas and suggestions that can help him overcome that triggers. And again, that's part of the closeness where, you know, none of us wish that we'd ever been through this, but we have the opportunity to have an even stronger relationship on the other side. And part of that comes from, I think marriage is the ideal ground for spiritual growth and for emotional and, you know, that kind of maturing growth. And so I think that if he shares with her, she may be part of his healing from those triggers.
Great answer.
And this is Mona. The other advantage to doing exactly what Ann said, which is taking those to her, because by not taking those to her, it's putting another form of secrecy between them, well-intentioned or not. But the other advantage of taking them to her is that as she watches him process through those feelings and emotions and perhaps even opportunities, it's going to help both of them give some concrete foundation to what he's going to put in place to prevent himself from ever going there again. Mm. And that's an awesome thing to do together, because that's how you rebuild trust.
Well, and I think, you know, whether it's the betrayed spouse or the unfaithful spouse, the more they're able to share their struggles, their feelings with each other, they can develop not just true emotional intimacy, but they can also develop an empathy for the other.
And just, you know, for the betrayed spouses out there, it just seems like the whole world is a reminder when you're coming out of this. I mean, it seems like every song on the radio, every plot line in a movie or television show seems to be about infidelity. And just, you know, all the places, all the restaurants, all the everything, you know, furniture in your house can be triggers. It's just a very, very difficult thing. But, yeah, I think agree wholeheartedly with what the other panelists were saying with the if there's a secrecy aspect to it, no matter what your intentions are, if infidelity, if the most bare definition is really the keeping of secrets, you're in a way perpetuating the infidelity by keeping secrets, even if you feel like it's in the best interest of your spouse.
One other aspect too is if you're just dealing with feelings and temptations. I mean, one of the things we say is temptation doesn't define you. You know, if temptation defined you, then someone like Jesus, who had lots of temptations, would be the vilest person, and he wasn't vile. The problem is what we do with temptation, and the problem is what we do with feelings. Feelings are really, if he's got feelings, being able to be honest about those feelings, that's the one common denominator that they've got to talk about. It's not accusatory. It's just, I'm hurt about this. I'm struggling with this. You know, that is just, you may disagree with what somebody thinks about something or what they do, but you can't disagree about the feelings. So if your mate can deal with that, man, that is just wonderful, because it only builds connection between the two of you if you can do feelings. So if the marriage is over, why not end it before consummating a new relationship and creating chaos and wreckage for all those involved? In other words, why does someone have an affair rather than just ending a marriage?
This is Leslie. You know, going back to something that John was talking about earlier, that, you know, a lot of people don't one day go out and say, I'm going to have an affair. Shirley Glass, in her research, you know, said that, you know, over 90% of married people said monogamy was important. And at the same time, 50% of those people who had responded to her survey admitted to having been unfaithful. And so, you know, a lot of times the person who has been betrayed feels like, you know, this other person made a conscious choice one day and went out when, you know, the person who's unfaithful has complete responsibility for their actions. But a lot of times it starts, you know, with a friendship or, you know, lunch. And it progresses. And all of a sudden they're in a place that they hadn't really planned on being. That it's more about, you know, does this person have good boundaries or not? I think really that the number one way to have an affair is to say, I would never have an affair, because I think that person is very naive about their boundaries and their possible emotional attachments. And so they begin to put themselves in relationships that take away from the marriage, that are not safe for the marriage. And they think that somehow they're beyond that, that they would never do that, and that's exactly where they end up.
I think something I would add, too, is that, you know, kind of to diss my own gender a little bit here, that One thing that Shirley Glass and other researchers have commented on too is the male's ability to compartmentalize things. You know, oftentimes women who have been betrayed will look at their husband's behavior through the lens of how they what they would have to be going through before they would cheat on their husbands. And men very often, in their minds at least, can feel like they're completely devoted to their wives and families and still leave little secret rooms for them to have secret lives. And again, I'm not trying to justify that behavior or anything, but I think what happens sometimes is women trying to understand their husband's affairs will look at it from a very female perspective and not understand that sort of, you know, I'll say that sick ability among we as men to compartmentalize things.
Right. Here's another question here. My husband has been gone from our home for over a year now and shows no signs of coming back. I'm trying to move on but find it very difficult, and I'm still emotional about it. When I get overly sad and emotional and have all these feelings of missing him and wanting him to come back, how do I get beyond that? I know I need to move forward, but it's still difficult because I still love him, though he cheated on me. So how do you move on from something like that, guys?
This is when the person's out of their life.
Yeah, they're gone.
And they're longing for them. I think, my immediate answer is you have to really embrace a legitimate period of grieving in your life and to really come to terms with all the layers of loss, that it's not just one loss, that there's symbolic losses, there's physical losses, there's familial losses, and to really give yourself the space to emotionally process the depth of all of that. I mean, I don't think, something like love is a switch you can just turn off and make a conscious effort, you know, to think your way out of loving somebody. You really have to emotionally kind of embrace the season to let that reality sink in.
Well, and I think, this is Wesley, I think it's really helpful for a person in that position as they go through the grieving to let go of the fantasy of that person coming back. It's a hard thing to really accept your marriage is over and your spouse is gone. I remember, going through that myself. And it took quite a while for me to actually accept the fact that he was gone. He had chosen to leave and he wasn't coming back. And so it is a little bit like a death. You have to sort of bury that part of your life and then begin to, slowly rebuild it without them in the picture. And I think sometimes, I'll have clients that will come in and they'll say, well, I've lost my family. And they've lost their family the way it was, but they haven't lost their family if they have kids. It's just their family has been reconfigured. But it is a hard thing to accept. But once you begin to accept it and grieve it and let go, then you can begin to go on.
Okay. Here's another question. Anne, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. How long is recovery going to take? It's been 2 years and the pain is still severe. What do you think, Anne?
Well, that's one of those things we're always looking for an answer of how long it takes. And I think one of the people who was attending my band group back when I led a local group in my community said it so well. She said, I'm sick and tired of people telling me how long it's going to take, as if I'm going to recover in 2 years, 5 months, another week, 3 days, and 6 hours and 2.7 seconds. Like, it's not so exact as that. I think affair recovery experts generally agree that it takes a minimum of 2 years to fully recover. Brian and I have seen couples recover at least, we're looking at them a year out and going, man, this couple's doing great. Are we missing something? But we also see a common denominator among those couples that we're seeing that are healing quicker, and those are the ones that are finding our help within the first month of recovery. And when we look at the situation closely, what we're starting to see is it's it's actually not the affair itself that is the hardest to recover from. And I don't want to diminish for a moment how difficult it is to recover from an affair, but generally speaking, it seems to be all the damage that spouses do to each other after the disclosure of the affair that becomes the even bigger deal to recover from. So how long recovery takes depends on, are you getting good help? How quickly have you gotten good help? What are you doing to recover? It depends on your personal choices and your ability to bounce back. I mean, some people we've noticed have had a lot of pain in their lives, other pain that may be bad childhoods and things they've had to recover from, so they've almost developed a skill in dealing with pain and a skill in forgiveness, whereas others have had relatively good lives, have had really happy childhoods, haven't had to deal with major obstacles, and then bam, you throw an affair on them, and they don't have as much skill to deal with it. So really hard. And you know, to put a time limit on it, you know, when you, my fear would be that somebody would be listening to this call who's 3 years out, and then they start saying, oh, see, you're such a loser, you haven't healed yet. You know, as long as you're moving forward in the healing journey, it's getting better all the time. That's the main thing.
And this is Mona. The other question I would add to that is, when they say it's been 2 years since disclosure, I would want to know how long it's been since both husband and wife have been working together to rebuild their marriage. The contact with the partner was definitely over, and that everything had been revealed. Because if you spend 6 months or a year dealing with those issues, and we often have couples where it's been 8 months after disclosure before those things have fallen into place, then their affair recovery begins in our mind when they both start working together, everything's been revealed, and the affair has ended.
Yeah, and that's where I think if we have any betrayers listening out there, if you haven't come clean on everything, you know, there's few things worse for a betrayed spouse than eight months into this thing where they really feel like they're starting to get some hope again, to get a new piece of information or a new revelation that can knock them all the way back to square one again. So,
right.
You know, it's generally better just to get it all out there.
Well, and I really appreciate the thoughts that you all are sharing. I guess one of the things, as I think about how long recovery can take, I think it can depend definitely on how long did the infidelity occur. You know, if that's a big part of it. How repentant, you know, was your spouse? Are they grieved over the pain they've caused? Are they involved? And a lot of times, you know, something that you touched on, Anne, that if they have trauma that they haven't dealt with in the past, then a lot of that will come up with the disclosure. And so they may not just be dealing with one thing. They may be dealing with a lot of different things.
So, and I think that is, yeah, I mean, I think you've got to have more information to answer that. I mean, that's a great answer. Here's a good one, though, I think. This is from an unfaithful mate. It's, I'm trying to understand my wife and answer all of her questions that she has about the affair. My question is, what kinds of questions are good for her to ask? And to me, the asking of questions and how to ask questions, that is a great little topic here. So I'd love for everybody to weigh in on that one. What types of information do you think that hurt spouse really needs to get? John, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. I mean, I think on that one, we sometimes advocate, you know, just to start this out, a 24-hour rule before, you know, because there's this tendency on the front end to do this rapid-fire questioning kind of thing, and then they find that they've gotten information they weren't really ready for. I mean, I certainly think the betrayed spouse needs to be the keeper of the drawbridge on the information. And they have a right to complete transparency and whatever they need on that. But you know, we always advise that they be really prayerful about what they hear. I mean, certainly there's some people who, if they get too much information, will be overwhelmed with the little details and little graphic things that they really didn't want to know. Whereas there's other people, if they don't have all the details, they will create in their minds a picture of something that never really was, and they'll make it into something worse than there was. They'll tend to make it look more erotic, more romantic, more whatever, when that probably wasn't the case. But that's where I think there's no universal way to answer that, but you have to kind of address it on a case-by-case basis, but that each person is being very mindful and prayerful about how much they really want to know.
Well, and a lot of times when I'm talking to the betrayed spouse and they're, you know, considering what they need to know, I will have them consider what their motivation is in asking and what's the potential benefit. But I think for sure they need to know, you know, when did it start, when did it finish, and what was involved. You know, not necessarily the details of it, but the broad landscape of it. Because I've had clients that they didn't want to know anything, and I don't think that that's helpful for either party.
And what would you say?
Well, one thing that really strikes me about this particular question is it's the person who had the affair that's saying, what types of information should my spouse know? And I would like to say to anybody on that side of the coin is that you probably shouldn't be telling your spouse what they should and shouldn't know. That needs to come from a professional or from another source, another betrayed spouse who's mentoring them, somebody along those lines, because I feel a little tinge of, yeah, that's not okay for you to be deciding that. It sounds, like you're trying to cop out of answering things. So it's not for the unfaithful to decide how much the betrayed needs to know or doesn't need to know. And other than that, I just, you know, think that the answers that have been given are great. I love what Leslie said about the, you know, ask yourself the motive for asking the question. Is it for potential benefit? I would really reiterate that. And to be ready, I always tell people, because the betrayed needs to be, as you say, the gatekeeper in charge of how fast the information is coming. So they ask the questions and they set the pace for the healing. So as a betrayed spouse, I always say you need to imagine that the answer to the big question you want to ask is going to be the answer you don't want to hear. And unless you truly can say to yourself that you're ready to hear that answer and be okay, then you're not ready to ask yet. And slow is fast when it comes to a fair recovery. So just be sure that you're ready for those answers before you're asking those questions. And maybe the last thing I want to say is that the goal here in healing is the honesty. I mean, if we could emphasize one point, you know, that's what it is, getting honesty and truth in the relationship. That's what you want. It has so impacted me how, you know, with Peggy and James Vaughn, he had had 7 years of multiple affairs for, you know, a longer period of time. And the last I checked, they've had 35 years of monogamy since this time went on. Yet their commitment to one another, they did not commit monogamy to each other in their own affair recovery. Instead, they committed honesty to each other, that they would never tell each other a lie again. And the honesty led to monogamy. So if you want to get honesty in your relationship, you have to remember that, and I'm talking to betrayed spouses, that as human beings, we are somewhat driven psychologically by pain and pleasure. Things that we do that bring us pleasure, we will want to repeat, and things that we do that bring us pain, we will want to avoid. So if I punish my spouse for being honest by freaking out or using their answers as ammunition in future arguments, then basically I'm punishing my spouse for being honest, and it's less likely that I'm going to get more honesty. So as betrayed spouses, when we get those answers, we sometimes need to learn how to just simply say, thank you for being truthful, and not responding anymore. And I remember in my own affair recovery, I did that many times with the tears, the silent tears, just rolling down my cheeks. But thank you for telling me the truth.
Hello?
Yes.
I'm someone that just joined. Is it okay for me to ask a question?
Yeah, you can ask a question.
I was just wanting to know, what does recovery look like? What is it supposed to look like?
Okay.
When a spouse has been separated and decides to come home and reintegrate in the family and work on their marriage, what should they be doing, and what should the interaction be on a daily basis?
What does recovery look like, guys? Anybody? Mona, what do you think recovery looks like?
I think recovery is as individual as the individuals in the marriage. I don't know that there's any specific prescription other than transparent honesty is one that we underscore all the time. If you have been separated and your husband or wife has returned and you're living together again, my question back to you is, what did you guys determine to do or not do when that move back into the house occurred, or was any of that discussed?
Actually, they're off the line at this point.
Oh, okay. So I don't know. It's too. I couldn't give a blanket statement other than transparent honesty and a lot of communication.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess my immediate answer is kind of expect the unexpected, and it can be just an incredible roller coaster ride emotionally and spiritually, physically, psychologically, whatever. It's and there's no kind of hard and fast one size fits all formula that applies to everybody.
Well, and I guess, you know, when I think about recovery, you have, you know, recovery for the betrayed spouse, you have recovery for the unfaithful spouse, and then you have recovery connected to the marriage. So I actually think, you know, there are three different paths of recovery that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I think the recovery for the betrayed spouse is a lot like normal grieving. But as Don mentioned earlier, you know, a lot of times they're doing it alone. They're not telling people, you know, there's no ceremony or ritual. And so it's more of a stigmatized grieving process. And so I think there are critical components that a person has to go through to come out onto the other side. And one of the things I think is most important is forgiveness, that the betrayed spouse has to forgive, the unfaithful spouse has to forgive, and that there has to be forgiveness to be able to have real reconciliation and in a development of, you know, not just honesty, which we've talked about a lot, and you know, I don't think we've overemphasized it, being authentic, but that each develops an empathy for the other. So the affair is not between them; they've been able to join each other, and the affair is outside.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Here is one. I think I know the answer to this one that y'all are going to give, but how do you get him to agree to get help when he's in denial?
So what do you think we're going to say?
Well, I guess the first thing, whoever wrote the question, I hope they're not in denial. Because as long as they're not in denial, I guess I would just sit there and say, you know, that there really does come a time where I think you have a choice and you say, you know, it's not okay. To not address this issue, because it puts all of us in jeopardy. And, you know, certainly I'm one of those that if there are other people that can be involved in this process that are really close to him, that can also talk with him to help address this issue with him, I think that's a great way to start. If he continues to be in denial, I think there's nothing to get a guy's attention better than cardboard boxes. And I think that's probably where tough love comes in. So anybody else want to add to that one?
Can I just make a sort of a more general statement, Rick?
Yeah.
I mean, one thing that as a sort of a former betrayed man myself, I mean, one thing I would like to say that I think sometimes a lot of the language that we use tends to indicate that the male has been the betrayer in infidelity. A lot of the literature that's out there is about, you know, dealing with your unfaithful husband and everything. And I do want to just kind of say to those listeners out there that there are a lot of hurting men who are in this position too. And, you know, and it can feel particularly insulting to guys who've been betrayed when they turn on talk shows and you know, see a panel of betrayed women and so forth, and they feel like that they're not being represented. So that was just my personal soapbox moment. Appreciate you letting me talk.
John, I'm glad you made that soapbox moment because I know that I've talked to many, many men who feel that way. So thanks
right.
for making
you
it.
You bet.
Absolutely. here's one.
Hello?
Yes. Was somebody going to say something else? Ann or Mona?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. he cheated in 1977 and 1980. I feel like that's where I'm at. The pain of all this sometimes is so unbearable. I go over both of them at nights, over and over in my head. I remember in 1977 I was 4 months pregnant with our son, and in 1980 I remember what she had on that night when I first met her. Everything is like it happened yesterday, so fresh in my mind. My husband and I love each other very much and have been trying to work through this pain, but sometimes I feel like, okay, things will be fine, and then it starts all over for me, hurting, crying, not thinking, I can't go through another day. My asking questions again and again, asking him why, how could you do this, why couldn't you be strong enough to say no, why couldn't you say no, I love my wife, I know that's what I would have done if it was me. My question is, I want to live in 2009 and let go of 1977 and 1980. Where do I start?
I can start with that one, Rick, if you like.
Okay.
I would say that one thing that's been quite a revelation to me is that there is a part of the healing journey that belongs, if you will, ever so cautiously, I'm going to use the word, to the victim. And I would like to draw an analogy to a situation that's different. Let's say, for example, somebody is raped. It's not very likely that you're going to be restored to the person that raped you, and it's not very likely they're going to be sorry, or you even will get any of your questions answered. And it's not fair, but the work of healing is going to then rest on the victim. You as a victim, when you've been the victim of a crime, you choose either you're going to stay hurt by what happened to you for the rest of your life, or you're going to find a way, whether it takes 30 books, you know, a couple of years of counseling or whatever it takes for you to get the answers that you need to get, that you're healing, that you need. But the bottom line is that there is a piece of the healing that in the final end only the victim can do, because no one else can jump into your brain and deal with your thoughts. And while we don't have a choice over the fleeting thoughts that come into our mind, we do have a choice over what we choose to dwell on in the end. In my own situation, I gave myself 2 years to get through this. That was my coping mechanism. I had to put a timeline on it because up until that point, I wasn't sure I was going to stay in my marriage. And the two-year mark hit, and at that point, my husband had done a lot of good things, but I still felt pretty crappy. And basically, I just kind of drew a line in the sand, if you will. I felt that it would be cruel of me to stay in the marriage if I could not truly get past it, because in essence, my husband had committed, I love to call affairs not mistakes, that word is anger rising, but a crime. Because a marriage has laws, and an affair is a crime against the laws of the marriage. And so the crime against the marriage is so big that there is nothing that anyone can do to make it up to a person. And so, you know, I took my time, and I actually had a ritual, and a ritual might be helpful for some people. For me, I went hiking in the beautiful mountains in Vancouver here where I live, And I took my pad of paper and my notebook with me, and I went to writing again, and I wrote down all of the things that my husband had done against me, all the affair and everything related to it. And I wrote down beside each thing how all those things made me feel. And I sat and I cried, and then I said, Anne, you have a choice. You can hang on to this for the rest of your life, or you can choose to let it go. And I threw this paper into the river, watched it go. Now, my feelings did not line up. It wasn't like I was better the moment I threw that into the river. But when I had the thoughts come my way, I would consciously go, no, I'm moving on. I forgave that. I'm going to think about my future. And that's back to those thoughts. And so and in the first day, it was like every 5 minutes or every 2 minutes. And then I could start to go 10 minutes without thinking about it. Then I would go 15 minutes. And then the next thing you know, a whole day went by and I didn't think about it. But I'm not sure I could have gotten better if I hadn't put that effort in. So I don't know. It's okay if others disagree with me, but that's how I find there's a work that belongs to, that the victim is the only one who can do.
Yeah, and I actually really appreciate what you say on that. And I don't want to suggest that this is the case of the person who wrote this question, but I've worked with a lot of people who their pain becomes almost like an emotional teddy bear that they don't want to let go of at some level, because there's a predictability of being able to go back into that place, or that there may be some leverage that they feel in the marriage, that they have that trump card that they can always throw out there whenever there's an argument. And again, I'm not trying to minimize the pain of this individual, but I would ask people who are really getting stuck to prayerfully ask themselves and look at themselves if there's a part of them that's wanting to hold on to this for whatever reason, even if it's kind of beneath their immediate awareness.
And this is Mona. I agree with everything they've said. If you were to sit down with this woman and she were to convey to us that, yes, indeed, they had gone through a healing process, that her husband had worked with her, We just had a gal in a group last year who had spent 15 years doing the same thing, and it had gotten so complicated that she even resented the fact that she'd lost 15 years of her life on this. And her solution, or one of the things that they did, is she sought some resources to help her move forward. They did end up coming to our group together, so her husband was in support of helping her move forward. And then one of the things that she ended up doing was taking a journey that revisited all the places where the occurrences were earlier, and did some almost like a ritual, like you described, Anne, where she had to release that journey at those places. She was able to move forward, but it took some real effort and energy and seeking resources to enable her to do that.
Good stuff.
Well, and I think, for some people, it's hard to let go of what could have been.
Yes.
The fantasy of the past they wish they had. One of my favorite definitions of forgiveness is giving up the hope of ever having a better past. Because I so appreciate what everybody has been saying on this, but I do think that... for a lot of people, they have trouble letting go of the fantasy of what might have been, and they get stuck there.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Which brings me to a very practical question. My husband's affair was with someone at work, and he still works with her. How do I trust him there if he still has contact with her? That's a toughie. I know everybody's probably, this is about rebuilding trust, our number one question here. Anybody want to tackle that one?
That can be a really tall order. I mean, I'd say if it is imperative that they stay in that work environment, I would sure want to see whole lots of layers of accountability and boundaries. But I sort of being in the emotional proximity of that person, I sure wouldn't feel safe. Being a betrayed spouse looking at that situation.
Yeah, any of you ladies want to tackle that one?
Well, this is Mona. We do see that with some of our couples. certainly if there is some real direct and constant interaction between the person who was unfaithful and their partner, I don't see how that can work on a day-to-day, five-day-a-week basis. But we have had some situations where the unfaithful person and their partner had an occasional contact. And what we have seen work with the couples who have mutually agreed that for whatever reason, the job needs to stay the way it is and leaving is not the best option for their family, that they discuss together the boundaries and the hedges that are in place. And some of them are very extreme. Some of them are a cell phone that's on every time there's contact.
Right.
You know, I couldn't presume to say what would have to be the case for this particular instance, but what I would say is that both the husband and the wife need to be in total agreement on what those hedges are going to be, and that unfaithful person needs to be just so constant and affirming about each and every one of those. I have seen it work on a rare basis when that occurs.
Right, and I would agree with that. I actually have seen it work in situations where you put boundaries up where, like, we do a thing called a weather report where the unfaithful spouse is willing to, you know, give a check-in each day about what's going on, and where there are a lot of what-ifs, like you said, the hedges and boundaries in place. And we do the cell phone thing, too, where if there has to be contact, you know, there's always, if they're in a meeting together, then, you know, they kind of tether home and use the cell phone so, to help let the other person know that everything is safe.
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, I just remember we had this just a couple of weeks ago, and it was really interesting because they had this particular instance was they have meetings like once a quarter or something, and the meeting just happened, and this is relative, I think it's within the first year of this couple's recovery, and he actually texted her the seating arrangement in the room. And it was so reaffirming to her because she had, of course, envisioned them side by side, you know, with these loving glances between them. And when he texted her the seating arrangement, she could see that they really were, it was difficult to even look at one another. And it was so reassuring to her that he did that. So.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was going to allude to as well, is that if that is the situation, then I think the person who's been the betrayer needs to be very proactive about being the one who's checking in and reporting, because you don't want to put the betrayed spouse in the position of having to be their probation officer and try to eke the information out of them, because that's an unfair position to put them in.
One of the things that I will add to, because this is, you know, great things that are being said, is that I think what Mona said, I want to emphasize that she said mutually agreed.
Right.
And I think that a point of choice comes in here. If the one who had the affair is like, look, I need this job, I can't do anything else, I just have to do it, then the betrayed is likely to feel escalated in their levels of mistrust. But if the unfaithful were to come to them and say, you know what, I have no idea where I would ever get another job, and in these economic times, and you know, I've been with this company for 20 years and leaving would be so hard, but I want you to know that if it's your choice, I would be willing to take this risk, honey. You need to know that you are more important to me than my job. And I've seen, you know, two things happen out of a commitment like that. One, I've seen people leave that workplace and, you know, go through maybe a little bit of difficulty, and a couple of years later come up with a better job than what they even had before. Who knew that God could actually provide? Secondly, if not the case, the very fact that the person made that offer has changed everything in the way that the betrayed spouse feels about them working together, and then they move on to mutually agreeing and discussing, okay, what hedges can we put in place, what guidelines, how can we create accountability, and so that kind of a strategy can definitely work. But when the unfaithful says, look, I'm just not even going to consider changing my job, that's tough.
Yeah, exactly. How about this one? If a spouse comes home what precautions should a betrayed spouse require for the unfaithful to do? Example, change cell phones, no contact with the affair partner, etc. What's a reasonable request?
I would say all of those things are reasonable. The only problem that I've run into is that when you say, I'm going to require this, because I remember in my own healing journey, one of the first things that I did when Brian decided to come home was I booked an appointment with a counselor. And to my utter shock, Brian informed me that he wasn't going. And I thought, what do you mean you're not going? You just had an affair. Clearly we need help. And he said, no, told me that I had been controlling him all our marriage and that he wasn't going to be controlled by me anymore. And I'll just qualify this, and, you know, that wasn't actually the case, but that was some of the typical blame and, you know, defensiveness that comes out from a person often when they're first back. And but what I did that was very helpful for me, and this might be something that other betrayed spouses might do in that situation, is I made a list of the qualities that I expected in a husband if I was going to stay married to any person. And it was not a pie-in-the-sky Prince Charming list. Like, this is the minimum standards. I am not going to be married to somebody unless they meet these standards. And it gave me a measurement. And then I thought to myself, because Brian was fighting against some of these things, I said, well, who am I to tell him how to get there? But if he doesn't become this man, I am going to give myself permission to leave, and I'm giving him a couple of years to get there. That was my approach. And so basically what I'm saying is when I told Brian, you must do this, he automatically wasn't doing it. So, but he did all the right things to heal our marriage, but he chose it on his own, and that was empowering for him. But I still needed my standard of accountability to see him moving forward. And so, you know, that might be helpful for someone on the call.
Well, and this is Leslie. A lot of times when I'm talking to people about this issue, instead of approaching it as these are my requirements, I think if they're able to say these things will help me feel safer.
Yes.
That that's a very reasonable request.
Yes.
Because there are things that the unfaithful person can do to help their spouse feel safer, and I think it's important for them to be able to do it. I guess the thing that I would also add to that is that I think sometimes people take too much, they have too much security in changing the cell phones and a lot of those things. I think those things can be helpful, but I also think maybe a month down the road when they've begun to talk more openly about what's been going on. Because sometimes, you know, people will say, well, you need to change this, change this, change this, change this. And they're not even really done with the affair. And so they take too much security in the changes, and the honesty hasn't been established yet.
Yeah, and I know, and you know, my take on this is that what's going to be needed is going to vary on a case-by-case basis, depending on the kind of affair and where the person is and all that sort of thing. But, and I know that it's that the word reasonable is a very subjective kind of term, but generally I think it's erring on the side of the betrayed or the betrayer taking a stance of whatever you need from me or whatever it takes to get this thing back on track. I think if there's any kind of defensiveness, or if they're showing that they're only sort of putting half-hearted effort forward and everything, it's going to be very difficult for the betrayed to move on at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Should I talk to the woman? This is Rick. Here's a great question. Should I talk to the woman who is with my husband so that I can hear her side of the story and be sure that my husband has been telling me the truth? I'd like to know her thoughts.
This is Leslie, and it's interesting because I think a lot of people naturally want to do that and think that that's going to be helpful, but it hardly ever is. And I guess the question I have for people in that position is, why do they think their spouse's affair partner is going to be honest? Because a lot of times they're not. And so then they're in the position of who do I believe and who's lying, and there's just a whole other layer.
Which lie do I believe out of all the lies that are floating around?
Yeah, because and sometimes the affair partner will begin to spin things. I've had so much damage done to betrayed spouses who contacted affair partners. The damage was done by the affair partner.
Yeah, sometimes they'll go into a competitive kind of dynamic and actually intentionally say things that are hurtful to the betrayed spouse. And I agree with Leslie. You know, if I'm looking for the truth, I'm not going to go asking a liar for the truth.
Absolutely. Guys, we're within 5 minutes of the end of the call. I wanted to give everybody just a minute to wrap up, and I'm going to keep it pretty close to 60 seconds if you want to just add something. So to close out, Mona, you want to start us off? I know you think fast on your feet.
Yeah, no pressure there, huh?
Are you standing, Mona?
Why'd you pick me first? No, just to wrap up in general. Okay, wrapping up in general for the betrayal.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, just anything you want to add.
Okay, well, this entire teleseminar has been directed towards betrayed spouses. So I'm going to assume that that is our audience, and I guess my primary message to any that are listening is that I was a betrayed spouse. My husband's affair lasted 3 years. It was with one of my best friends. Now we're 15 years post-revelation. We have healed. We went through the healing process. It was the most difficult thing we ever did, but it was worth everything it costs. And so I would say to any betrayed spouse out there, that your marriage and the relationship with your husband or wife is worth it, that healing can indeed be done. It is hard work, and I would caution you to be much more afraid of not healing than to actually go through the healing process.
Thank you. Well done, Mona.
Well, you set the bar pretty high for being put on the spot like that.
Okay, John, why don't you try to be the one to call it?
I would just want to kind of speak that same message of hopefulness. I mean, when I went through all of this, it was just like an absolute train wreck, and you know, legitimately wondered if the sky in my world would ever be blue again, and want to say to everybody out there who's really devastated right now that I don't think any of us would probably do this for a living if all we saw was the train wreck side of it. We see lots of people come through this and come out on the other side, not just kind of recovered, but actually better off than they were before. And that may just sound incredibly just ridiculous to you right now. But I, you know, from a spiritual standpoint, I think God tends to do his best work in our broken places. And it's amazing kind of to see the way that people do come out of this. And, you know, and just to my colleagues here, I just wanted to say it's been really nice to sit and just kind of sit at your feet, as it were, to hear what you had to say and kind of learn and grow from your wisdom, and have really enjoyed this.
Miss Ann, what would you say?
Yeah, those are high bars to finish off with, but I just want every person who has been on this call to know that, and I can hear it in the voices of every other person that's been on this panel, that we love you. We love you. We care about you. Passionately so. That is why we do what we do. And so don't stop until you get all the way to the healing. You know where our websites are. You know how to find our resources, and you know how to contact our offices. So do whatever it takes to get healed, and know that you do not have to do this alone.
Thank you. Leslie?
Well, I guess if I just kind of, you know, think about things in general, I would say to you, the betrayed spouse, that regardless of what your spouse does or doesn't do, regardless of whether there is hope for the marriage or not, I truly believe that as you use well the circumstances that you never would have chosen, you can actually benefit. And I don't say that lightly because, you know, as we've all shared, that this has been our journey. And there's no way around the pain. There aren't any shortcuts. A lot of people want a quick fix, a way through, and I don't believe that that's to your benefit. I think as you can choose to use your recovery well, you can grow in your awareness, your experience of God's love. And I think, you know, the bottom line in all of this is to do what God's calling you to do. A lot of times people say, should I stay, should I go? I think it's important to really seek God in that question and to do what he tells you to do. Because I think as you, you know, choose God, you will benefit, regardless of what your spouse does or doesn't do. And something that Mona kind of touched on, I would just emphasize, it's easy every day to go, well, should I stay, should I go? I would challenge you to pick a date in the future, you know, maybe a year from now. Write it down on the calendar and say, you know, I'll get back to that question then. And every day get up and say, you know, God, what are you asking me to do? And do it. And let go of watching your spouse so carefully. And lean into God with all your might and ask him for everything you need.
And to close, guys, there have been over 400 people on this call, which is amazing. I want to thank all of you for, you know, joining us and just making this a big success. If you signed up for this call, we're going to be sending out just some free material from Harboring Hope and A Fair Recovery. We're still working with Mona and them. We're going to be giving you their resources. So please let us help. We really want to just facilitate your healing, your journey. And please hear what Ann said and all of us. We've been there, and we care deeply. There are people who care, so don't be alone if you're isolated out there. Join one of the groups around here. And God bless everyone, and this is such a big success, I'm sure, since we've got over 400 people. We will do this again in the future, right, ladies and gentlemen?
That's right. I actually will say it felt to me that when all – I mean, we all do this work, and we normally do it individually, but I really felt there was a synergy as we work together and
mm-hmm.
you pool,
mm-hmm.
I feel like saying the minds on this. I felt it was really a powerful experience, and I hope everyone on the call felt that way, too. It was just that there was more.
Absolutely, and it's really nice to get to know you, Anne, and Mona a little bit. Very much have enjoyed it.
And I have, too. Thank you.
And next time we'll have a few more like Joe and Mark and Debbie Laser, and so it'll
mm-hmm.
be great.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, guys. Everybody have a great evening.
And good night.
Good night.
Thank you
good
very
night.
Much. Good night.
Bye.